Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get to what seems to be a daily drop of news on the world of artificial intelligence. A lot going on. Alphabet's Google I.O. Annual Developers Conference, that's happening today. It's expected to talk about a lot of different AI features for its search business and broader ecosystem. This event coming one day after a similar one from OpenAI, where it launched a faster and cheaper version of its ChatGPT model. So let's get to our tracker of all things artificial intelligence. Bloomberg News AI reporter Rachel Metz. We caught up with her at last week's Bloomberg Technology Summit, got a great rundown on all things AI. But as we said, everything's happening or something new every day, it feels like. She's with us from San Francisco. All right, Rachel, let's start with what we got from OpenAI. Faster, cheaper model. What's different from the version that everybody's been talking about for the last year and a half?
Hello. Yeah. So we have GPT-4o. The O in OpenAI speak stands for Omni Model. And basically what that means is they used to take a bunch of models that could do different things and chain them together. And now what they're going to be doing is they're sort of pushing it all into one AI model. And that's part of why they say they're able to make it faster. So they can do things like a much more close to real-time audio interaction, which makes it feel more lifelike. Like if you're talking to the app right now and you want it to talk back to you, you're gonna have to wait. Like there's, you know, like there's some very clear latency, and then it will respond in one of the several voices it has in there. With this upcoming voice feature, it's very snappy from what they demonstrated, like almost instantaneous, as though I were talking to another person.
All right, so there's that going on. I think it's interesting, you know, ChatGPT, right? It's kind of the gold standard, and I feel like everything is kind of measured off of that. Is that fair?
I mean, I think that it is fair in that people seem to be using it a lot. I mean, I think the figure that we have was like, what is it, like 100 million users or 100, something like that. People have used it. It's quite popular. And yeah, I think people think about it as sort of a gold standard in terms of what one can do right now. What is state of the art and replicable with a chatbot? So yeah, I think that's kind of a fair barometer.
So here's the question I have relative to the Google statement. You know, I've been using Google literally since late 90s, 2000, something like that.
Yeah. Probably,
and
right?
The concept of organizing the world's information, they always did that really well till about, I don't know, 5 years ago. And suddenly search just became festooned with sponsored answers and ads and then Google's own products. And sometimes you have to go like three or four screens down to actually find a search result. And my personal search seems to be less on Google and more on products like Perplexity, which uses either the Claude or the Shannon or a couple of different AI
right.
engines. And I find the answers I get are so much better and the list of sources so much better
elsewhere?
Than fighting on Perplexity, than fighting through the Google homepage. I'm wondering how much of this AI built into the search bar is a recognition of Google search has really become, you know, fairly mediocre compared to being the best there was.
Well, Rachel, come on in on that. And I'm curious about, you know, at this developer conference event, you know, what are we learning in terms of the on the AI front that might help maybe change Barry's view when it comes to Google and Alphabet?
Sure. I mean, I think you're right about Perplexity. A lot of people have been drawn to it. It seems to be combining a lot of things in a really smart way. When I use it, I'm struck by how well it puts things together, and it has some good like follow-up questions I might want to ask, things like that, insights its sources. So like from my reporting, we know that OpenAI is working on its own search project, which may be similar to Perplexity. And we saw this morning that Google said it's going to going to make the sort of like AI assisted answers that right now are sort of an optional thing. It's going to make those a more integrated part of its search results. So if that works for you, and we'll probably have to see over time, that could make it so you feel better about the results that you're getting. But I guess for me personally, I'm still kind of wary of trusting anything that's AI assisted unless I check with a source. You know, Perplexity obviously is really good for that. So I think it's going to take some time still for us to figure out like what works best, and how we should put these tools together. And, you know, maybe you'll use Google for certain things, Perplexity for other things, OpenAI for yet other things.
Yeah, you always have to double check that hallucinations are not part of your answer. and that is the technical term for when AI either finds something wrong on the internet or just kind of spitballs and makes it up, things that are wildly wrong. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Bill Dudley of the New York Fed, and I was kind of surprised to learn from AI that he was an NFL fullback in the 1940s, especially because he wasn't born until the 1950s.
That would be a hallucination.
Yeah. So
listen, Rachel, just got
the same name, right?
Yep,
and it just
same
conflates
name.
Those. I mean, there's multiple Rachel Metzes out there, and AI sometimes will conflate us. I have multiple jobs, according to AI, that I've never had. You know, things like that.
You would think intelligence would say, oh, this was before he was born.
Right.
Maybe it's less intelligent than we're giving it credit. Although Jim O'Shaughnessy said, AI today is the worst it'll ever be. It's only getting better every day.
Listen, the more data you put in, right, Rachel? Just got 20 seconds, the better it's going to become, we assume.
That's what people have been saying, but I don't know. I think we may, we've been seeing those kinds of results. That is true. But we'll see over the next few years if more compute, more data really does lead to better AI.
Yeah, it's only going to be better as good as I guess the data is. Rachel, I know a lot going on, and we appreciate you jumping in. Bloomberg News AI reporter Rachel Metz.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We'll talk about veterans on Wall Street. We often mean individuals who have worked there a long time, seen lots of market cycles. People like Barry have lots of experience investing and trading in global financial markets. But it is also about the growing relationship between Wall Street firms and U.S. military veterans who, after serving their country, find a second chapter working at financial firms around the country. And that includes at Wells Fargo, which last year hired over 1,100 veterans, with 4% of Wells Fargo employees self-identifying as a veteran. Two members of its board of directors are U.S. veterans. Bloomberg, by the way, hosting today the Wells Fargo Military Appreciation Event. With more, we welcome John Weiss. He's co-CEO of Wells Fargo Corporate and Investment Bank, joining us here in studio as the daughter of a vet, cousin's brother. I salute you, and I think it's really important that we remember those who serve our country. And I want to talk about that in a moment.
I salute your father.
Thank you. He and his brothers, World War II, all of them, all came home, which was pretty remarkable. I want to ask you, though, because you have such a great lens on the world, and I think we're at this interesting juncture in terms of trying to figure out the way forward, the business environment, the macro environment, the deal environment. How would you describe kind of where we are?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And we're delighted to be collaborating with Bloomberg on this important topic of veterans. As to the macro picture, you know, it's, a unique time. I would say that the U.S. economy is quite resilient, and, you know, it's a good place to be headquartered. You know, every new piece of economic information sends us darting in one direction or another, and we've got CPI tomorrow, and The PPI that came out this morning is encouraging from a standpoint of, as the market digested it at least, encouraging from the standpoint of maybe a somewhat better inflation picture. But CPI is the important data point for this week, so we'll see how that comes out tomorrow. Deal activity, business activity, actually quite good. I would say there's a lot of pent-up demand, certainly a lot of private equity capital out there.
Looking to make those exits, right?
Yeah, on the one hand, looking to make exits, and on the other hand, looking to make investments.
Interesting,
So both sides of the deal are covered there. And I would say strategics are getting a little bit more impatient about pursuing their own strategic goals. So I feel things are reasonably stable right now. As stable as you could say they could be.
You sound a little cautious.
Given that we've got, a war going on in the Middle East, a war going on in Europe, and a lot of uncertainty around the U.S. election. So given all those things, it's remarkable how well the economy and the market seem to be digesting it all.
So let's use those two wars as a leaping off point to discuss the work that you guys are doing with veterans. In my office, my CFO used to be a tank commander in Afghanistan. Our head trader sat in the back of EC2 Hawkeyes directing all the traffic over Iraq during that war. What led, and by the way, they're fantastic and there are secret weapons. What led Wells Fargo down the path to, hey, we really want to recruit from this pool of people? How did you discover what an amazing talent pool and set of skills exists there?
Well, the first thing I would say is I don't think we're completely unique in this area. I think Wall Street in general has been very supportive of veterans.
Very welcoming.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, look, we're always looking for talent. And when you are looking, as we are in our industry, for people that perform well under pressure, that would naturally bring you to this population of people who have learned to serve and to execute under pressure. And then there's, of course, the
it's a trait you recognize, right, John, in terms of, yeah.
Just get it done. Like, whatever we have to do, just get it done. I love that attitude.
It's absolutely the case. And then there's the last thing, which is, of course, we're supportive for social reasons. These are people that, in some cases, gave their all, but their friends certainly did, and they served their country, and a part of our responsibility is to help them transition back into society.
Because it's interesting, because I feel like, and I don't want to be, so critical of the government, but it does feel like people come home and then they don't have homes, they don't have jobs. You guys actually get into some of the basic needs.
Yeah.
It's about providing jobs, but it's providing things like homes.
But let's start with jobs. Within the corporate and investment bank, you mentioned that we've hired as a company 1,100 veterans this year. That's a pretty good pace, but mm-hmm. we could probably do more. On the corporate and investment side, we have various programs that allow us to bring veterans on board for summer associate roles, for more permanent assignments. We're working with some of our clients to recognize the talent of their vets and give them opportunities to continue
their
careers.
That's what I think is interesting. Yeah. When we talk about diversity, inclusion, equality, it's the supply chain, the pipeline. It's not just what you do at your company, but
it's working with your clients. We work with a lot of veteran-owned broker-dealers, for example, mm-hmm. and we bring them into deals, and we try to help train their people in products and services that we provide that maybe they don't have the same depth in.
That's really quite fascinating, especially when you think about the problems we've seen in VA hospitals and things. Getting people on your payroll with your health care has to be a huge life upgrade for them.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, career matters, right, to overall livelihood. But getting back to the question that Carol asked a minute ago. So yes, the company very specifically has focused on the veteran population as an area for focus. And that focus takes... comes in different ways. We've on an annual basis given donated new cars free of financing to veterans. We've donated something in the neighborhood of 400 homes over the last 10 years. This is providing housing free to veterans. And we don't look at it as a handout. We look at, and this is an often used phrase, we look at it as a hand up, because what they really need is some assistance, and they will pay that debt back. They already have, to society. So we feel really good about it. And we also give a lot of funding out of our foundation to various veteran causes.
I always think about the audience who's listening, and I think, again, we, you know, have, you know, segments of our society and population that are forgotten, including the vets. You know, is there a message that you think more widely that we should all think about as we go about our business on a daily basis?
I mean, it's not going to be a new idea to people, but we all live our lives in a very safe place, and it's because there are people out there protecting us. Whether those are first responders here in, you know, domestic U.S. or members of the military serving outside the U.S. So I guess the message is we are all in this together, and we all have to bear our share of the responsibility.
How do you think about the future in terms of what Wells Fargo wants to do next?
What we want to do next?
Is it just more and just continue to build it out?
More, yes. Better, absolutely. You know, we're focused as a company on running the bank better, serving our clients better, managing risk better, and just being a better run organization overall.
Yeah, really, just really fascinating. And I do think about it. I think unless you've, maybe if you've had somebody in your life, like you say, you've got people working, or I've got it certainly in my family, many members, several have done tours in the Middle East. And I do think there's something about this environment right now where we're very sensitive to sending American soldiers over to some extent. But it's just the role the United States plays globally in kind of protecting the world. Like, you just have to think about it, and we take it for granted to some extent.
You know, after 20 years of war in the Middle East, I think the country kind of has gotten fatigued, and it's easy to forget about the people coming home who then have to just turn their life upside down to normalize things. We've been a little negligent paying attention to them. I'm glad to hear you guys are moving in this direction, and have been in this direction for quite some time.
Well, as a child of the 60s, all right, we can't forget some of the lessons of the 60s. And one of them was certainly welcoming the veteran back after the war, which we did not as well as we should have in the 60s. We certainly did, I think, well post-World War II. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we're doing a better job today.
It's interesting that you bring it, because I think about when my dad and his brothers came home and the GI Bill and going to school, and it was such a welcoming back, if you will, and such a support system, and that it's just kind of amazing to see kind of where it's gone. What do you think it is about the financial community? As you said, not just Wells Fargo, but we talk about it a lot here at Bloomberg in terms of the financial community and their support of veterans in particular. What do you think it is about that?
I think, I don't know, maybe part of it is the focus of New York City and understanding what happens when things do go wrong, which, you know, those of us who lived through 9/11 certainly remember. But, it, you know, it's also it's a part of society that wants to prove its sense of responsibility. I think Wall Street really does care about its image, and it cares, you know, in a real way about carrying its share of responsibility.
Yeah.
And when you look at the veterans, these are people who understand risk. They understand working within a team and leadership, and the parallels are just all there. If you want someone who has your back, whether you're in the field or on a desk, it's hard to do better than military veterans.
It just makes a lot of sense. John, great to catch up with you and just kind of hear about the work you guys are doing. Looking forward to hearing more. I know we're going to have another member of your team a little bit later on Bloomberg, so looking forward to it.
And you'll be hearing from Mike Riley, who runs or co-heads our markets division, who is a vet,
Navy, right?
Navy, ex-submarine commander.
Wow.
You talk about somebody you want to have, you know, having your back. Mike's the guy.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Weiss, he's co-CEO of Wells Fargo Corporate and Investment Bank.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, folks. Sit down, grab something to drink, because this is a story of broken dreams. It's also a story that's among our most read on the Bloomberg today. It's a story about IM Academy, also known as the Harvard of Trading, that grew from a small New York operation into a global phenomenon during the pandemic by selling the promise that it could teach anyone, particularly teens and 20-somethings, how to become a savvy retail investor for a fee, of course. It promised a lot and many lost a lot. We wanted to know more about this story. So with us is Bloomberg News personal finance reporter Alice Cantor. She's joining us from London, where we know it's a little bit later. So Alice, we so appreciate you hanging around to talk with us. This story, by the way, to be featured in the forthcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. You can read it now on the Bloomberg and also find it at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. First of all, a story like this, Alice, how did you first come across it?
Hi, Carol. Well, hello. First, thanks for having me on. It was in the midst of the pandemic, actually, and I was looking at stories around financial crimes in France, because at the time I was in Paris, and I saw this like small news website that did an investigation about IM Academy in France, and it was about all these teenagers who were getting really excited in the pandemic about making money from meme stocks and Bitcoin. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Mm-hmm. And they had come across IM Academy, this company that promised them that within a few months, they could really become multimillionaires. They could earn a passive income if they just knew the right strategy to trade online. You know, this company had the recipe for them. So yeah, I started digging into it and found out that France was just one of the many, many countries that this New York-based company had expanded in and was making a lot of victims, essentially.
Well, and I want to get into the size and scope in terms of how many got impacted, but tell me like how it works. I mean, I've kind of read through here, so I have an idea. But tell our world how this company worked, how it said, okay, you're going to make money, and you know what was involved in terms of becoming a member and what you had to kind of give across. Because you had to pay a fee, right, to be a part of this.
Yeah, so initially it worked like any subscription to an online product. It's like an online educational platform. So you paid $250 to join, and then you'd have to pay $250 every month to keep having access to this online platform. And on the platform, you'd get sort of pre-recorded videos of so-called IM educators that would teach you the basics of markets, you know, what. How do you make a stop loss? How do you figure out a difference in percentage points, and how do you take advantage of that? And then they also said, well, they have this amazing algorithm that charts prices of currencies and stocks and any financial product. And this algorithm can sort of tell you when a price is going to go up or going to go down. And so if you just pay the subscription, you'll have access to all that information, and you can really quite quickly earn money by using that trading advice and learning how to read those graphs.
I feel like a lot of folks in the financial community would be like, wait a minute, like, what is this algorithm? And it almost sounds too good to be true. Tell us about that. They targeted really a younger generation. How did they do that? I mean, it sounds like, you know, I was looking through it, you know, it almost sounds like there were influencers on there about like, look at all the money you can grow, you can make here.
Absolutely. So at the end of the day, the software that they promoted, the algorithm, doesn't work. It's very basic. Mm-hmm. It's not really predictive. But they really lured people in through the lifestyle that you could have once you get those millions. And they did that on social media. And essentially, the CEO of the company hired these really muscular, energetic salesmen that went on Instagram and showed their lives on a Dubai yacht or at a five-star villa in Italy, saying, "Look, I'm this rich. You know, I'm you want to be like me? Well, why don't you just join IM? And this is the recipe for success, essentially." So that's really how they attracted people that way.
Who's behind it all? Tell us a bit about the company's CEO and how he did in all of this.
Yeah, so Chris Terry is a man who was born in the Bronx, and he started working construction. He had apparently, the construction company had ties to a mob family, and he had to pay a fine. He was like implicated in a criminal conspiracy, so that's where he started, and he likes to mention his mob background quite often. But then he went on to Amway and was a salesman for another multi-level marketing company. And then after that, he tried to build a reputation of himself as a trader, saying he was managing hedge funds and he knew all about financial markets. But really, he was never a financial broker. He has no financial real accreditation from any real U.S. institution. And he's made very well for himself. So he's definitely a multimillionaire. IM at its height in the pandemic was selling the equivalent of $500 to $600 million in subscriptions.
Wow.
For the year. And he flies around in his private jet and has a bunch of condos around the world in Dubai, in Las Vegas, in New York. So he's making a lot of money from all this.
Tell us about, I mean, so he made a lot of money, but tell us about some of the individuals who paid, who got a part of the platform, did some of the trading, some of these young individuals, some really sad stories in terms of what happened to them. They lost a lot.
Yeah, so people would come in thinking, I'm going to learn all about retail trading, make a lot of money. And what happens is not only do they pay the subscription, but often they start trading and kind of gambling their money away using strategies that don't work. So pretty quickly, they'll have a lot of losses. But what IM educators will tell them then is, well, there's this other side of the business. You can earn a commission if you sell subscriptions to other members. And so that's the multi-level marketing aspect mm-hmm. of it. And so where it gets a bit tricky and where people feel like they can't leave the company and they end up losing way more than just like a regular, you know, financial service is that these teenagers end up really kind of being gaslit and a little bit sort of brainwashed into believing that, you know, it's their life's purpose to be in this company. They have to keep trying to recruit. They have to keep bringing in more people. If they're failing, it's their fault. So there's this whole strategy to keep people involved, to keep people selling more subscriptions to others, even when they realize the trading lessons are really basic and not helpful at all.
It does sound like, and I know you get into this, I mean, it's prime for regulators, it feels like, to take a look, Alice. Where are we on that front? Because it sounds like this, you know, has to be on their radar.
Absolutely. So, I mean, across Europe, a bunch of investigations are open at the moment, but nothing has really happened so far. And then the biggest investigation that's ongoing right now is by the FTC in the US that is looking at IM Academy. They're reviewing complaints, they're talking to the CEO, and well, it looks like there might be in discussions to kind of try to put an end to this company's activities. But to be honest with you, Carol, there's not that many regulations around multi-level marketing companies or these kinds of financial education platforms, so they might just go on, they might just like filter through all these regulations that come kind of they might pay a fine and just get on with their business.
Yeah, I do wonder on something like this. I mean, is it kind of eyes wide open if you're going to pay money? Like, you have to kind of know what you're getting into. Or is it a case of, is there a way of proving, and I'm not saying there is, but, you know, fraud of some sort in promising an algorithm that's going to kind of do everything? Or do we all just kind of know that maybe if it sounds too good to be true, it's not going to be true?
Well, yes, they can be liable for making false income claims. Mm-hmm. So early on, they would have people on Instagram posting like pictures of their Rolexes and bills and saying, you know, I make 10 grand a month in passive earning and passive income. So those kinds of figures can really put the company in difficulty because you're not allowed to make these claims unless you can back them up. And in this case, they can't. Yeah. So that's one area that's problematic. The other one is that they say they don't give financial advice, but really they kind of do. And they almost trade for the people that are part of the company. It's kind of tricky, but they usually just
right.
Like tell them which brokers to go with. They used to mirror trades automatically. So just like copy and paste trades from traders and give it to Alice, the members.
I have to ask you, I only got about 30 seconds. So just quickly, company is still active?
Yes, it is still active. I was just at a conference there in Budapest that they had a huge company rally a few months ago. So they're still active and doing well.
I got to say, you paint such incredible pictures in this story. I feel like it's like a mini documentary just waiting to happen. But it sounds like the story is still to be played out here. So we'll continue to follow any updates. So glad we could get some time with you to kind of spell it out for us. As we said, it's among the most read stories on the Bloomberg today. Alice Cantor, she's Bloomberg News personal finance reporter, joining us from London. And as we said, among the most read, and you can check it out. It is also going to be in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week that's coming out later on this week. And it's also already on the Bloomberg. Coming up next, we talk a little bit about the workspace, freelance workers. There are a lot out there.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Headlines I just wanted to mention in the last 24 hours or so. Converse cutting jobs as part of parent Nike's cost savings plan. Walmart axing hundreds of corporate jobs and asking most remote workers to return to offices, according to a person familiar with the matter. And Fed Chair Jay Powell earlier today weighing in from Amsterdam in a moderated conversation, saying there are signs of gradual cooling and rebalancing in the U.S. labor market, and yet at the same time how the U.S. is still experiencing labor shortage in many industries. All right. So we wanted to talk a little bit more about what's going on in the workforce. So we welcome back Kelly Monahan. She's managing director of the Employment Upwork Research Institute, which is a division of the publicly held online recruitment and marketplace company Upwork. She joins us from Florida. Kelly, great to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. You guys have some new research on Gen Z. Those born, I guess, was it the late 1990s, early 2010, some 20% of our population. Why, first of all, did you focus on this group in particular?
Yeah, that's a great question. The reason why we zoomed in on Gen Z was two reasons. The first is at the end of this year, they're going to actually overtake, in terms of percentage of workforce, the baby boomers. So just by their sheer size, it's important we understand where they're coming into the workforce. And it's also graduation season. And so we wanted to also help Gen Zers navigate the new world of work they find themselves entering.
I got to say, walking in and around New York City, there's a lot of universities. So a lot of Columbia grads getting ready for graduation ceremonies. So it was interesting to walk around. So you guys did some research into this group. So what are first of all, let's start big and broad. What are the big findings that you guys came up with?
Yeah, the biggest finding, I think, is actually a big wake-up call for leaders today. And what Gen Z told us in our research is that they want to work differently than the typical employment model is today. Our most highly skilled and highly educated freelancers are wanting to be entrepreneurs, and they're actually finding a more stable career path towards managing a portfolio of freelance projects, as an example, in order to diversify their project work and diversify their income. As we think about all the things that Gen Z has grown up in, an unstable economy, the pandemic, they're really looking to take much more control and individualize their work. And so that, to me, is a big wake-up call to leaders today to think through Gen Z signaling to us that the way that we've structured work is broken to them. They want more control and flexibility over the way they're working today.
Kelly, do they really, really, really want it? Or is it just kind of what's coming to them? And I ask that because, I mean, I get it. I'm in the media world. I've seen lots of freelance work. And I think some do really like it. But many are still seeking out kind of that full-time gig. I mean, do they really want this to be so many different, maybe smaller jobs, if you will, that kind of add up to a whole?
That's such a great question. And here's what we're finding within the data. Those that have a post-grad degree are the ones that are actually more likely to be structuring work this way. And I think the reason is what they really, really want to answer the question is flexibility. And I think, you know, as we think through the RTO headlines that are coming back, the layoffs that have occurred, especially within the tech industry, mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest with you, I think it spooked this generation a bit. And they're realizing that traditional contract with one employer being tethered to one organization can't get them to where they want to go fast enough. And especially given the economic conditions they're growing up in, the cost to buy a house, the cost to buy a car, groceries, all this is so much more expensive. And so again, those that are highly educated and can really write their own ticket, having the right skill sets that are in demand, we see in our data set are actually opting towards, again, these aren't going to be your short, typical gig type projects. So these aren't going to be the people necessarily driving an Uber car or doing DoorDash. These are the people who are going to come in and are tackling machine learning or data science or your content creators and working on longer term complex projects that, quite frankly, as an early career professional walking into corporate America, they might not have the opportunity to do.
Because I do wonder too, and just, you know, indulge me for a moment. Like, I do think I watch, sure. you know, kind of the younger nieces and nephews in my world and just, yeah, like the flexibility, but then they get married and they have kids and then they become very 9 to 5 and they have to buy a house. And so they want the benefits, the healthcare. Because I do think about that part of, you know, when you are piecing together freelance work, you don't have all the amenities that you might get from a full-time job.
You know, I think this is such a great question you have. And really, I'm calling this like the Gen Z paradox mm-hmm. that we're seeing, because you're right. I think there's the reality of the macroeconomic conditions we're facing today that are requiring a really need for income and to get it faster and to get promoted faster. And so there's these expectations of wanting more because of this. And yet there's just a strong demand and desire for autonomy and flexibility. And some, like, when you can craft both of those things, I think that's the best of both worlds. You're absolutely correct, though, that I think the reality that many are struggling with and the paradox they find themselves facing is, what one do they have to choose? And again, where they are right now, they're younger in their careers, and you see this across many generations, you're willing to take risks. You're able to try to think about entrepreneurship because you're at that right life stage to do so. The more that you age, and to your point, the more responsibilities and, quite frankly, the costs you incur, I think Gen Z is trying to weigh out, how long is it going to take me to climb that corporate ladder? Do I have enough stability? Am I going to end up getting laid off? Hmm. Is this a safer route to actually diversify? And I think those are questions that we're seeing played out in real time today by this generation.
All right. So then is there a message to corporate America? You're saying, hey, folks, this is what's happening with the current workforce. You better wake up, especially when, you know, when did I talk about Walmart saying, hey, folks, we want you back at the office.
Yeah, I found that so actually fascinating. So I was listening to you opening up the segment. So I think this is a big wake-up call for corporate America today. We know, like, the idea of work feeling broken and that, you know, we see the stats all the time that Gallup reports on. Employee engagement mm-hmm. is not off the charts. It's low. Most people are struggling today. And so there's something systematically broken about the way that we've structured work today in the age of AI, in the age of distributed work. We have all these new technologies that I think are causing workers to think differently because they're behaving differently as customers. And yet it's harder for us to move our organizational practices, our systems and technologies that we built around that is much more centered around this long-term employment contract. The reality is that's not the way the world's working today. Customers are demanding much more speed and convenience. And because of that, that's really disrupted the entire way leaders are thinking about work. And so the wake-up call is you can't continue to do business as usual. If your plan is to attract and retain Gen Z talent by doing what you're doing today, I'm going to be honest with you, there's not enough Gen Zers coming up the ranks. Baby boomers are retiring at faster rates. In some industries, it's 5-to-1 ratio where baby boomers are leaving to every one Gen Zer. So we've got to wake up. We've got to figure out how to make work for the majority of people today. And I think that requires some deep systematic change.
Is there anything, though, I'm going to throw out artificial intelligence, and anybody who's smart talks about it and says we're very early in terms of the impact it's going to have on the workforce. Although, having said that, there are folks out there that are already saying we're a little worried about the jobs that are going to be taken or replaced by Gen AI, machine learning, and so on. Gen Z, in terms of how they approach AI, anything constructive that you guys are coming up with yet?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one big thing that I'm seeing that's a behavior change in Gen Z compared to other generations is they are adopting this technology much faster than other cohorts. And they're doing so in two ways. One is that they are self-directed their learning. Because they're digitally native cohort, they're not afraid to take these online courses. They're not afraid to actually learn through online mechanisms. And so they're embracing this and are much more likely to have a certificate today in AI as an example. But here's the other thing, and this is what I actually think is so interesting. They're much more willing to go for coaching and advice to systems like ChatGPT. So these large language models, they're a bit more organic and inherent in the way that they're interacting with them to get advice. Gen Z in particular hates inefficiency. And so their ability to actually utilize these tools to work faster is really mind-blowing to me. And so I do think this generation is going to help us shape what this world of work is going to look like in an age of AI. I think the message is like, if you're not Gen Z, we got to play catch up with the rest of our older generations.
I do want to be smart, because I know I always get emails like after I have a conversation like this and they say, well, wait a minute. Like, you look at a lot of the pandemic darling stocks, kind of funny that we're talking about meme stocks today. But you saw like such an uptick in things that benefited because we were shut down. People were laid off. There were just things we did differently. Small businesses were being created. Are we kind of, though, in terms of people with freelance, generally speaking, or doing it on their own, kind of getting back more to 2019 levels? And forgive me, I've only got about 30 seconds. Got to be quick.
There's no problem. Yeah, no worries. So absolutely, the pandemic has accelerated this. But I will tell you from our research, Gen Z, who's doing this from a full-time basis, have been doing it for 2+ years. So I do think there's a trend that we've got to watch out for. I do think it's going to be much more mainstream and not just a pandemic blip.
All right. We're going to leave it on that note. Kelly, great to get some time with you. Dr. Kelly Monahan, she's Managing Director of Upwork Research Institute, joining us from Florida. And still got a few weeks before we get our next monthly read on the labor market, but something to think about, especially when it comes to kind of a younger generation.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us. You drive me crazy.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just got about just under 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Let's get to it. Our Drive to the Close guest, a special guest, Michael Riley, co-head of markets at Wells Fargo Corporate and Investment Bank here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Also participating in the Wells Fargo Military Appreciation Event here at Bloomberg headquarters today. Michael, by the way, a decorated officer in the Navy where he served aboard the nuclear submarine USS USS Memphis. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I think my brother was on the Abraham Lincoln. We were talking before we got started because he was also in the Navy. I want to ask you, I feel like there's a million places I want to go, but I want to ask you about being in the Navy, what you learned, and how that kind of translated to being in the financial industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I get that question a lot, especially from people, from veterans as they're trying to transition out, because they don't necessarily know as much about the financial industry as they would if they had been gone through school. I had an undergraduate business degree, but I was also a chemical engineer, right? So ultimately, yeah. I was an engineer. So I didn't really know that much about it either, just from talking to people and networking, right? I think you know, and you asked the question, to answer your question in terms of what did I learn, I mean, certainly perseverance is one thing, right? And personal responsibility around things. I think being in the military, you're thrown into a role of responsibility much faster than most people coming out of directly out of college, right? So, you know, when I came out of college, I was put on a nuclear submarine, you know, basically to run a nuclear reactor 500 feet underwater, right? So
not much pressure, not too much responsibility.
Yeah, so not many people have had that experience. I mean, certainly some, but you know, it was something. It was a life experience that you know, a lot of people will never get to experience.
Well, and I think about kind of what you're doing, markets, and I feel like this environment, the M&A environment, right? I mean, it's a tricky one. I think people are trying to figure the way forward. You were just at Milken. We were talking a little bit about it. I was at Milken. It felt like that there was a lot more optimism than we've seen certainly the last 2 years. How do you see the macro environment right now?
Yeah, I mean, look, there certainly is a lot of optimism, right? I think that people have already started to look forward towards the rate cuts. I think part of the problem is they've been looking forward for a year now.
Is that a mistake in your view?
I think it has been historically, but I mean, you know, it's worked so far, and hopefully things will kind of coast in, you know, over the next 6-ish to 9 months. I mean, now the speculation is, I mean, at least probability would say that, you know, the next cut would probably be, or the first cut would probably be sometime in at the September meeting. I mean, that's our view as a house, but we'll see.
But we get CPI tomorrow, and then we get.
Yeah, I mean, our view was that we would cut in June too. So, like, I mean, it just keeps getting pushed out. I think there's just too much uncertainty around you know, conflicting inflationary data versus jobs data. Right?
Does it matter? Like, I think about in your markets group, right? You guys are up about 37% year over year in the last earnings report. Markets division in general. You also saw gains in investment banking, the trading market space as well. I mean, volatility, like traders love volatility. That's a good thing. And you anticipate that continues?
I do. So we were up 37% last year versus the year before. This year, we're kind of on par for where we were last year. So it's not really a huge gain. But I mean, certainly volatility helps. There was a lot of volatility, especially in the beginning of last year,
right,
when it came to the regional bank issues that we had. And my expectation is there will be volatility into the second half of the year. What we've really seen so far this year is, you know, a very robust issuance calendar, especially on the debt side.
Mm-hmm.
And the speculation is a lot of that is just stuff being pulled forward, because as you get closer and closer to the election, the uncertainty around that certainly will cause market volatility, but it also causes uncertainty. So, you know, corporates want to get their funding out of the way now and try to roll all that forward. At least that's the expectation.
But a sign of a healthy market that they're doing that and being able to do that.
Yes. Oh, it's very healthy. I mean, you know, yeah, and part of it is, you know, companies that are coming right now, right, certainly, you know, are in a you know, pretty stable, you know, cash flow standpoint.
Right.
But for the most part, you know, deals are getting done.
What do you make, Michael, though, of the M&A environment? $5.2 trillion in 2021, that was the peak.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the outlier, or I don't know, how do you see it right now?
I think, well, it's super positive. There's a lot of conversations happening from what we're hearing.
Yeah.
I think there is a little bit of uncertainty from a regulatory standpoint. There's been some deals that have been kind of, you know, haven't gone so well based on that. But I think there's a lot of optimism around M&A. I do. Yeah.
Is it mostly because of what's coming out of private equity in terms of needing to either do some exits, but also having a lot of cash still to put to work?
Yes, absolutely. There is a ton of cash.
Just the private equity part that maybe is fueling it?
I think that's part of what's keeping things moving, but it's not just private equity, right? It's companies that have, you know, strong cash positions that want to increase their business.
What's the biggest risk? What's the biggest thing that when you guys look at the outlook here? Because I do feel like depending on the day, depending on what either Fed speak or an economic data point or that, for the most part, is what kind of makes, you know, we see some movement in the markets.
Yeah. That's what's causing the market to move. And everybody is, you know, tied to the edge of their seat when it comes to things like CPI and data as it comes out, trying to speculate on the Fed. But I mean, it's pretty well telegraphed, right? Like, we know months ahead of time, or we think we'll know months ahead of time when things are going to happen. I think the biggest risk is, and I mean, we saw it, you know, happen, although the market didn't really react the way I would have expected them to react. But geopolitics has been a big issue, and it's quieted down a lot. That doesn't mean it's going to stay quiet. I think my personal opinion is that's the biggest risk, is something that we're not expecting from a geopolitical standpoint and starts to, you know, change the environment out there.
Which is pretty remarkable if you think of the last 2 years, right?
Absolutely.
That has certainly hit us hard, and we're not done yet, right, in terms of those two specific events, whether it's Ukraine and Russia or what's going on in the Middle East. You guys are here at Bloomberg headquarters doing this military appreciation event. I've had a great conversation with John Weiss of Wells Fargo about it. But when you think about veterans and the things that they need and the importance of making, you know, providing for them, whether it's mental health, whether it's needing a home, I mean, how do you think about it, and what's so important about it?
Yeah, look, I think when you really dig into it, veterans, right, have spent a period of time, a significant period of their time, right, basically serving their country, right? And it's not just the veterans, it's veterans' families, right? I tell people all the time, my wife actually had the hard job, right? Because I was on a nuclear submarine. My wife had a 1.5-year-old and a 6-month-old when I went on a 6-month deployment, right? So, you know, so it's transitioning out of the military, not just for veterans, but for veteran families, right? And making sure that we support them, because it's difficult. And you know, the military is really good at some things. Transitioning people out, once they're off the government payroll, they kind of become not really the government's responsibility anymore, right? So it's really up to us to kind of pick that up, right? Whether it's, you know, foundations and charitable contributions, et cetera, that's great, right? And you know, I think, and Wells Fargo specifically does a lot of that, right? But for me, it's actually more important around the employment and the education process, so that, you know, you can take veterans who are very proud people in general, mm-hmm. right? You get them and you teach them the ability to actually, you know, get a job, work and support their family, et cetera, you know, at a high level. And I think we've come a long way in the last 20 years, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Agreed. And it was interesting what you said about families. I've seen a lot of things too about whether it's PTSD and the impact. It's not only the soldier who is overseas, but it's also their families who have to live with it. Michael, thank you so much. And thanks for sharing it with our audience. Michael Riley, he's co-head of markets at Wells Fargo Corporate and Investment Bank, joining us here in studio. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.